Andrea, welcome back to COVID Race and Democracy. Can you please introduce yourself and then tell us about the International Indian Treaty Council?
Thank you, Ken, and thank you for inviting me on the program. My name is Andrea Kerman. I'm from the Yaqui Nation, which is half of it, of our traditional homeland, and our communities are in Arizona, United States, and half, including our traditional pueblos and governments and our traditional land base is in Sonora, Mexico, called Rio Yaqui, Sonora, Mexico. So our traditional lands are divided by that infamous international border between the United States and Mexico, which puts us in a very, very interesting and sometimes challenging position. And we share that situation with the Tonawtom that are our neighbors here and are dealing right now still with the construction of the border wall on traditional sites for them and traditional springs. So that does put us with a unique perspective on many of the issues that Indigenous peoples overall are addressing. I'm the executive director of the International Indian Treaty Council as well. Since October 1992, I've been in that role. As I mentioned before, I accepted a six-month interim from the then board president, William A. Means, Bill Means from South Dakota. And I've been in it ever since. Couldn't ever quite figure how to get out of it once I was there. So I decided I better learn how to do the job. And I'm still learning day by day. The International Indian Treaty Council was founded in 1974 on the Standing Rock Reservation, which now I'm happy to say everybody in the world knows where Standing Rock is. The meeting was attended by about 5,000 Indigenous delegates from throughout the Americas, not just from the U.S. and Canada. And it was the culmination of a time of a lot of conflict and resurgence of Indigenous peoples, especially in the United States, fishing rights struggles in the late 1960s on the Pacific coast, occupation of Alcatraz Island in 1969, Wounded Knee, longest walks across the country, occupation of the BIA building, court cases, a lot of people arrested and even killed. And of course, Leonard Peltier is still in federal prison from those days. And in 1974, at the meeting at Mobridge, South Dakota, on Standing Rock Reservation, the call was made to seek a voice in the international arena, a seat with the family of nations at the United Nations, specifically because with everything that Indigenous peoples had tried, nothing really worked. And in fact, there was even more repression than before. That the decision and consensus was not just in the U.S. and Canada, but throughout the whole American continent, that there was really no justice for Indigenous peoples within what's called the justice systems or legal systems of the settler governments that were more than anything part of the problem of the human rights violations, land rights, treaty rights, cultural destruction of our sites and many other factors, boarding schools that had seriously impacted our Indigenous languages and our whole social fabric. All of those things were directly attributed to the very countries that we were facing, the court systems and the laws and all those factors. So the International Indian Treaty Council was sent to seek a voice at the United Nations from that 1974 meeting. And in 1977, we helped organize the very first United Nations Conference of Indigenous Peoples focused on racial discrimination against Indigenous peoples of the Americas. And that same year, the IITC received what's called consultative status with the United Nations Economic and Social Council ECOSOC. The UN loves all these abbreviations, but it's ECOSOC. Now there are many, many hundreds, perhaps, of Indigenous organizations that participate, and Indigenous peoples and nations and councils that participate in various areas of the United Nations. But in 2011, the IATC was the only one so far that was upgraded to what's called general consultative status with ECOSOC, because we don't just work in the area of human rights now. We work in food sovereignty, climate change, biodiversity, environmental protection, a lot of the different international branches and arenas, because those are all areas that affect our rights and our voice. And we found that we've been able to make a lot of progress there. It took us 30 years, but we were able to achieve in 2007 the adoption by the UN General Assembly of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, recognizing our collective rights as peoples, not just individual human rights as persons, you could say, recognizing our treaty rights, our land rights, our right to self-determination as the fundamental right that affects all the other ones. So these are some of the things that we've been able to do, and we continue to build and expand. IITC is a representative organization, which means we have affiliates and members, not individuals, but you know, nations, tribes, organizations, traditional treaty councils, networks that make up the IITC, all the way from Arctic Village, Alaska, to Argentina, throughout the Americas, out on the Pacific Islands, and out to the Caribbean. So this is our representation, five different regions of Indigenous peoples that speak with a unified voice and work with Indigenous peoples from around the world to defend our rights and recognize the rights and struggles of our peoples in our own homelands.
Wow, that is really powerful and so inspiring to hear about the level of international coordination and the representation you've been able to build through decades of organizing. Let's focus in now on Indigenous land and water defenders who are at the forefront of protecting the global environment that every single one of us depends on for life. But they have been subjected to absolutely brutal attacks by corporate and imperial interests around the world. And these assaults have been getting even worse in the pandemic, haven't they?
They absolutely have. We are very gratified that the new United Nations Special Rapporteur, which rapporteur is a French word the UN uses for human rights investigator, and we were able to bring about the creation of this specific human rights mandate holder back in 2001. And right now, the position is held by our former board president, Francisco Calidzai. He stepped down from that role when he became a UN special rapporteur just last year. And right at the beginning of the pandemic, he took his seat, and his first study was on the rights of Indigenous peoples and COVID. So we began to collect information. We had several webinars that we informed Indigenous peoples around the world of this opportunity to voice our concerns. Of course, everybody knows that Indigenous peoples were especially hard hit by the pandemic, but not only because of lack of access to healthcare, but in our study, we really found time and time again that Indigenous peoples were voicing why their health was debilitated. And in many cases, it was because of decades or even centuries of environmental degradation on their lands that was exposing them to mining waste, nuclear fallout, toxic chemicals, pesticide sprays, you know, all of these different factors that had actually negatively impacted their ability for resistance. Another factor caused by many of the same reasons of the resource extraction and exploitation was the debilitation of Indigenous people's traditional food systems and food sovereignty, where we had originally access and a way to produce traditional, you know, strong foods. But everybody knows the high rates of diabetes and other kinds of diseases, cancers we suffer. And a lot of it is because now we don't have access to our traditional foods and waters and lands, or these essential elements for survival are contaminated. For example, I mentioned the Tonautum Nation, which is the neighbor of the Yaqui Nation, and they actually are the second largest land-based tribe in the United States. In an area as big as Connecticut, they have one grocery store that sells products from outside, owned by not the tribe, but outside business. And when the pandemic hit, suddenly, you know, all of the food was gone from the shelves. The Navajo Nation, many of the elders come into Gallup, New Mexico, to buy their food and get bottled water. And those borders were closed because they said, well, the Navajos are going to bring the pandemic, even though we know for a fact that the COVID-19 virus was brought into the Navajo Nation by non-Navajo evangelical Christians that held a revival meeting, and it just spread from there. And you could document that, you know, very easily. So that element, you know, had to be recognized, and we were able to get that, you know, known internationally, because it wasn't just here, it's in other countries as well, where Indigenous peoples have been the target of resource extraction with no concern for the environmental contamination left behind, the uranium mining here in the Southwest. And I mentioned the pesticide spraying affecting our Yaqui communities just across the border in Mexico, where, you know, all the kids have asthma during the time of year that the crops are being sprayed, many times with pesticides that have been banned for use by the exporting country, like the United States. You know, Monsanto and Bayer Crop Science in Germany, and that's still allowed under international law. So these were some of the reasons that we were especially vulnerable to the pandemic. But at the same time, we saw that corporations and governments were using the pandemic to push through development projects that had long been opposed by Indigenous peoples for the very reasons I'm talking about, because of the environmental contamination, because of destruction of sacred sites. Those were some of the reasons that we strongly supported the water rights defenders at Standing Rock and took that case as an urgent action for them to the United Nations to help get international attention around what was going on there. But I'll just read one quote that we received from our colleagues in Alberta, Canada. Treaties 1 through 11, the historic treaties in Canada, encompass about 240 distinct tribal nation governments, First Nations, as they call them there. And they are affiliates of IATC and sit on our board of directors. And we found out that on April 1st in 2020, the Alberta, Canada provincial government committed over $1 billion Canadian dollars to push for the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline on that side of the border, which is bringing that dirty tar sands oil, which has totally contaminated the water and traditional food sources of many Indigenous nations in Canada. You know, the target was to bring it through the middle of the United States, South Dakota, Rosebud. But he actually said that this is a good time to push it through because Because of COVID, people were distracted and Indigenous peoples could not gather in protest. He said he told an industry group that this is a good time to build tar sands oil pipelines because coronavirus restriction limit gatherings of protesters to 15 people in our Alberta, Canada. We are very gratified that the new U.S. administration, as one of its first acts, withdrew the permit for the Keystone XL pipeline on the U.S. side, or, you know, restored that withdrawal that the Obama administration had made, that the Trump administration quickly reversed that and, you know, was pushing through the pipelines, not just DAPL, but Keystone XL. So now I'm told that the people of Alberta, Canada, that put up all this tax money are quite enraged, even those that are in favor of the pipeline, that he should have thought this through more. But, you know, not just in the United States, in Brazil, in Colombia. In Colombia, we heard during the first 6 months of the pipeline, over 30 Indigenous human rights defenders had been killed. We saw the government of Brazil pushing through deforestation and major fires and basically displacing Indigenous peoples from their land, and a lot of human rights defenders being killed there too. It was interesting, and I do want to highlight this because we did an urgent action case to Francisco Calitzai, the rapporteur on rights of Indigenous peoples, along with the rapporteur on cultural rights and on religious freedom, because of the resistance of the Lakota, especially the Oglala, to the July 3rd political rally that the Trump administration, together hand in hand with the governor of South Dakota, held at Mount Rushmore, which is originally a sacred site that has already been desecrated by the carving of four big ugly heads, you know, in this sacred mountain. But the protesters blocked the road. And I just want to bring out that they actually were legally in the right, because even the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld that the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty is still valid and legally binding. The only problem is they offered money in exchange for taking of the Black Hills, where Mount Rushmore is located. And the Lakota have always refused that money under the slogan, "The Black Hills are not for sale." But Ken Tilson, or Ken Tilson was his grandpa, Nick Tilson, the director of Indian Collective, was one of the protesters that blockaded the road based on the fact that the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty affirms that those coming from outside into the treaty lands of the Lakota, the Ochete Sakoan, the Great Sioux Nation, as the treaty calls them, have to get consent. And not only did the Trump administration not get consent for this rally, there was actually a very strong opposition voiced by the tribes in the area, in part because their consent was not given. This is a sacred site and in their treaty lands, but also because their communities were already beginning to see, as many Indigenous peoples did, you know, around the U.S. and around the world, disproportionate levels of COVID for the reasons that I had mentioned before. So they didn't want these thousands of people to come in, and the governor had already said they wouldn't need masks and no social distancing. They were actually protecting their own people, especially the most vulnerable, our traditional elders, from exposure to COVID. But they were arrested for blockading the road into Mount Rushmore area. And Ken Tilson, or Nick, I keep saying Ken, that was his grandfather, is the first Tilson I met many years ago in Minneapolis. And then Mark's his dad, and now Nick was arrested, and he was actually facing 17 years on felonies for exercising his legal and treaty rights to protect the peoples and the land there. from this political rally that former President, ex-President Trump organized there on Mount Rushmore on July 3rd of last year. And the UN human rights mandate holders came out and said that the U.S. needed to drop all these charges and called for, based on that, a process by which the United States could work out in an equitable way the treaty violations that they had perpetrated, including the one that occurred last July. But all of these things have come out because of the COVID epidemic in part. And one thing that we've seen is in the study of the rapporteur that consistently the states and the countries that have Indigenous peoples have basically mainly totally ignored Indigenous peoples in their policies and programs to combat the virus. And also in some cases, like in South Dakota, taken action against those that we're trying to protect. You know, they also threatened the tribes that put up blockades on the reservations. So those coming in from outside couldn't, you know, bring more of the virus and further exposures. And they threatened the tribes, the state governor in South Dakota threatened the tribes there with legal action. They were not dissuaded, but, you know, this is the kind of thing, rather than saying, great, you know, you're supporting, trying to keep the levels of exposure down, they were actually met with the opposite response. So it's really important that these recommendations that went to the United Nations be heeded, that Indigenous peoples be included in the development of programs and projects to combat and also respond and build resiliency long-term in Indigenous communities facing this pandemic. This is not the first pandemic we've suffered, of course. Everyone remembers the smallpox blankets and flu and measles and other things that decimated many Indigenous nations. And probably, you know, with the way that things are going, there will be others. So it's really important that Indigenous peoples be included in developing programs, including taking into account our traditional healing methods and traditional health knowledge, but that also when we put programs and policies in place on our homelands, that those be not only respected, but supported by the states rather than moving against us instead. So I'm happy to say that maybe in part based on our work at the UN on Nick Tilson's case, all the charges have now been dropped. We're very happy that the permit for the Keystone XL pipeline now has been rescinded and that the DAPL pipeline is now in a process of review. Even though it's already been built and already spilled oil, there is a process now of review that includes the tribe, not just the environmental, but the cultural rights. So maybe our collective voices are being heard. The most important are there on the ground in the communities. But if the International Indian Treaty Council can support that by using the apparatuses that now do respect and reflect the rights of human rights defenders at the United Nations, we're really happy to support those struggles. But I just want to stress the most important are the resistance and the programs and the contributions and solutions proposed by Indigenous peoples on the ground in our communities and in our homelands.
Thank you, Andrea. I really appreciate that. I'd like us to take a step back for a little more historical context. You said that Indigenous peoples have been defending their lands, their resources, and cultures for centuries against colonial theft and genocide. And this was really the foundation that, along with slavery, launched this hyper-industrialized, white supremacist, U.S. empire that now threatens not only Indigenous peoples, but all life on the planet. So I'm wondering how you think about that link between the struggles of the past and the present.
Well, from our point of view, the past never really ended. There's not, you know, a place that says, okay, this is the line when the appropriation of Indigenous people's lands, waters, and resources ended. So now we're just dealing with the impacts. These activities continue, and the proposal for continued uranium mining, I think that's changing now with the new administration, but, you know, who knows, is going to be the next president. And so we're, you know, we kind of are buffeted back and forth, where last year, the Trump administration gave permission for the proposed uranium mining, long opposed by the Havasupai and other Indigenous peoples that would be affected in the Grand Canyon, right on the Colorado River, the drinking source for millions of people, even the people in Los Angeles and Phoenix and other places. But now I understand and am very gratified our colleague Carletta Tulusi, who's on the Tribal Council of the Havasupai and has been in the forefront nationally and internationally. We've credentialed her to go talk about this at the United Nations as well. She now is on an advisory board for the Biden administration on environmental protection. And it's, you know, quite a change, quite a switch. But one thing that we were able to really, you know, bring out in this discussion of COVID was, for example, the history of uranium mining on the Navajo and Pueblo reservations. They were actually designated, I think, by Richard Nixon when he was president as national sacrifice areas, meaning that those areas could become completely degraded for the sake of the arms race and the energy needs of the rest of the country. They actually called it that. So those tailings remain, those intergenerational effects remain, cancer rates, birth defects, those things are still very high. And as a result, you know, that those kind of debilities make Indigenous peoples much more vulnerable to the impacts of COVID, you know, with decreased immune systems, for example. So those effects are still there and they're intergenerational. So they really came to the forefront when people said, well, why are the Navajos, why is the Dene Nation so disproportionately affected? Why are some of the Pueblo communities so disproportionately affected? The actions of the past, and now uranium mining has stopped there, even though there's always discussion, depending on who's in the White House, about revitalizing it and starting it up again. But the intergenerational health impacts are still with us to this day. So, you know, the past is the present. And another example, of course, I think that you're referring to maybe climate change. I'm not sure if you know this, but I'm right now the co-chair of a new United Nations body at the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is ironic because that was probably one of the worst bodies for our participation over the years. We were not even allowed in the room when the Paris Agreement was negotiated. There were probably 200 Indigenous peoples there, but we had to negotiate on the outside and set up meetings with countries. And the only reason we even could figure out what was going on when they were negotiating it is we had a few Indigenous peoples that were credentialed by the state parties. So they couldn't say anything, but they could be there and let us know, you know, what was actually going on in there. But after 3 years or so, after the Paris Agreement, there was a call for recognition of Indigenous peoples' knowledge systems and our contributions and methodology. And so a new body was established called the Local Communities Indigenous Peoples Platform. And a facilitative working group was formed, made up of seven representatives of Indigenous peoples from the seven regions around the world and seven representatives of states, which is what countries are called at the UN, the states. And this is the first time in the 40-some year history of our work at the UN that Indigenous peoples got to choose our own representation there. Like everyone's heard of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, we can nominate members. They're called independent experts. They're not really representatives. But at the end of the day, the countries get to decide who will be selected. And sometimes we're happy with who gets selected. And sometimes we feel like they're not really the best nominee of who we put forward. So sometimes we think they're actually trying to weaken our voice at the United Nations that way. But in this case, Indigenous peoples got to choose our own representatives. And we're there to challenge the policies of the countries. The Paris Agreement calls for recognition of the rights of Indigenous peoples in all climate actions, which include the causes like pipelines, like fossil fuel development, the impacts on our homelands, as well as false solutions like carbon trading that are being pushed by some of the countries and corporations as well, so they can keep on polluting and then invest some money in saving a forest somewhere else. We're all for saving the forest. That's great, except that doesn't reduce emissions that cause climate change, because they're just trading their right to emit with investments somewhere else far away on saving a forest or doing other kinds of projects. So we're really, for the first time, really at the table in a UN body discussing the impacts of climate change, because everybody knows that Indigenous peoples are on the forefront. Some of our island peoples have already had to move. They have no more fresh water. All of our food systems are impacted. You know, taking it back home, last year was the hottest, driest summer ever recorded around our area in Tucson, Arizona, which affected everybody's ability to produce their traditional foods. We have a little family farm on our land here. My husband's a traditional farmer, and a lot of our crops didn't make it because they rely on the rainfall that comes in July and August. It's called the monsoons. It floods out areas, and that's the basis for the production of our food source. So this is just a little picture here of what's happening, but let's see if they really listen to us in this new UN body. It's second year of operation. As I mentioned, I'm the co-chair, but I'm also the representative for North America Indigenous peoples on this body. And we think the only reason they're listening to us now on climate change is they must be really scared, because they wouldn't even let us in the room before. Suddenly they've given us a seat at the table. Let's see if they listen to us. Let's see if they really understand our point of view about a radical change in their policies, in their practices, and in the dependence that the states and corporations continue to push on the fossil fuel economy, which causes climate change more than any other thing.
Yes, it's amazing that you've been able to get a seat at the table in the midst of such powerful and predatory corporate interests. And I think they'll really only listen when many more of us rise up and join in the battle. So where can people go to learn more or to get active in building solidarity with the movements of Indigenous peoples?
Well, we have a website, and we post regular updates there about Indigenous people's struggles in different places, including the struggles of human rights defenders and how they can be supported by other organizations. Our website, you can just Google International Indian Treaty Council or IITC, but it's www.iitc.org. We also have a quarterly, it's called e-news, which provides news and updates. It's on our website, and you can also find out how to subscribe there. And we also, through the e-news mailing list, send out flyers about activities coming up. We just finished with a practical knowledge sharing for Indigenous peoples, but everyone's welcome to attend our webinars. We're planning a virtual corn conference focusing on a lot of these same issues, but through the lens of corn as the basis of many Indigenous peoples' food systems and cultures throughout the Americas, Caribbean, and even into the Pacific. We found out that corn was traded with the Pacific Island Indigenous peoples through Easter Island, real name Rapa Nui, off the coast of Chile, way before the colonial era. So it's really amazing stories and that Indigenous peoples can share with each other. And also our methods, our seeds, which is especially important now in climate change, where a lot of Indigenous peoples are experiencing drought conditions. There are Indigenous people like the Hopi, for example, that have maintained drought-resistant seeds for millennium, since time immemorial. And now we need to trade those seeds with each other like we always did before. You know, we always traded, all the trade routes went up all the way from Argentina into Canada and beyond into the Pacific, you know. So these are things that everyone can find out about. We also have, you know, sign-on letters for different campaigns, challenges that we're making to states and UN bodies to comply with our understanding of our rights and our demands for the recognition of our rights as Indigenous peoples, our collective rights. You can also find out how, if you want to donate, we don't take money from governments at all. So it's kind of amazing how we've survived all these years, you know, on a shoestring. But there are ways that you can donate, several different options that are all on the website. There's a little tab that says to support our work. And all of these are ways that that everyone can get involved. But maybe the most important is just to find out what Indigenous struggles are happening in each of your areas, where Indigenous peoples are maybe not well known, a struggle to protect a burial ground or sacred site or get land back, you know, fight a corporation. The most important is find out what Indigenous peoples are doing in your area. Who were the Indigenous peoples there? We have a film called Gold, Greed, and Genocide about the real history of the California Gold Rush and a study guide that's starting to be used in schools, not just in California, but elsewhere. We have the original Gold, Greed, and Genocide film from 1999, the 150th anniversary of the Gold Rush. And we did a 20-year update just last year, talking about some of the work of the California Indian nations to revitalize their culture, get their land back, but also what we've been able to do at the United Nations to address the ongoing issue in California and anywhere where there were historic gold mines of mercury contamination. So those are just some of the resources that we provide, no charge for any of this. And we hope that you'll have an interest in following up and in supporting our work. Please feel free to contact the International Indian Treaty Council's offices. We have one in San Francisco, one here in Tucson, Arizona, and we're reopening our office in Guatemala right now. We're in the process of doing that, so we're real excited about that. So thank you. Thank you for your questions, and thank you everybody who's listening and wants to find out how to support the rights of Indigenous peoples and our struggles and our defenders of those rights here locally and all over the world.
Well, thank you so much for the deep insights and inspiration that you shared with us, Andrea. We really appreciate the work the International Indian Treaty Council is doing, and not just for Indigenous peoples, but really on behalf of every one of us. Is there anything else you wanted to say that I didn't ask you about?
No, just we really appreciate the interest in the perspectives and concerns of Indigenous peoples, as well as a recognition that we also have solutions to offer the world on all of these issues. We're not just, you know, complainers, even though we have a right and a responsibility to defend ourselves, but also we have solutions that we hope that the world we'll look at and take to heart and respect our knowledge systems and food systems and what we can offer the world community for a different approach to their relationship with Mother Earth and to other peoples that may think and look differently than themselves. We hope that those things can be taken to heart as we continue to offer our insights and knowledge, if we so choose, to others outside. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrea.